Take the bass line out. Uh-huh.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox Podcast. I am Dan Favalli, coming at you this time without my wonderful co-host, Andy Bailey, who is dealing with a massively sick family, just everybody across the board, kids, Shelby, his wife, everybody's sick, apparently. So we've called in the reinforcement of all enforcements, one of my good friends, a co-worker for almost a decade, who I've still never met in person, Bleacher Report's Grant Hughes, favorite of the pod here. He was going to get pestered, even though he didn't know it, for our next round of when we started to do off-season previews when the playoff stuff calmed down, but he was kind enough to come on for this Friday night, late Friday night edition of the pod, as we both are just watching Cleveland get de-fucking-stroyed by the Pacers in Game 6. Just a massive disaster. We're here to give you some post-mortems of the teams that have actually been eliminated, plus a quick preview of the Pelicans-Warriors series. If you want to follow Grant on Twitter, you need to do that. He's a great follow when he tweets. At @GT_Hughes, spelled exactly as it sounds. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. Let me sneak that in there. We really appreciate everyone leaving the comments. Also rating us, that's the best way to help the pod at this point, and it's always humbling to see what you guys think and just to see those rating numbers go up in general. But now we get down to it, and the question that everyone is dying to know before this pod even started: how are you doing, Grant?
Well, thank you for asking. I would like to be known as friend of the pod. I feel like that's, people say that on podcasts, you know, and they have recurring guests. I'm going to be friend of the pod. I feel like that's a good designation. I'm great. I'm digging the playoffs for sure. And I'm also, you mentioned the Cavs Pacers thing. Can we talk about how this series is going to go seven? But like, it really should have been over in like five in Indiana's favor. Cause the Cavs have a couple 3-point wins where if LeBron is like less than, like a superhero, they lose both. Like, short summation, Cleveland cannot win a title, right? Like, no way. There's no way. They should have been done.
No, they're not. That, I think that was clear before the playoffs started. I'm still just, I've entered this cruise control mode, maybe much like the Cavaliers defense, where I just pick LeBron because until he proves to be a bad bet, and it wouldn't surprise me to see them win Game 7. It wouldn't surprise me to see them beat the Raptors in Round 2. It wouldn't surprise me to see them get to the NBA Finals. Once they get there, whether it's the Rockets or the Warriors, I'm honestly wondering if they even push it to five.
Yeah, it's crazy. I'm kind of that way too, just because, you know, it's like the Spurs thing to, in some ways, where it's like, are the Spurs done? Are the Spurs done? It's like, well, no, and then they just make the playoffs again. But yeah, you ride with LeBron until it just doesn't work. But we passed the point where it should not have worked. This series should have been over. And Indiana's fine, but Indiana's not good. They're not a good playoff team. This is it. I mean, and I don't know. It's going to be fascinating when you guys do the postmortem for Cleveland, because I mean, all those questions are going to be, there's going to be a million really good questions, but we're not here to talk about the Cavs, are we?
No, it's going to be so weird if it ends up being the postmortem after round one. That's something even when the Cavs were rock bottom, I don't think anyone saw. And they've been, Tyronn Lue's been terrible. I'm done with the starting lineup with Jose Calderon in it. I don't know why he keeps, not only does he start it, but he rolls with it for forever. Kevin Love has been awful. He's also been like mutilated in the series. I feel like he's on the ground every other possession. I'm kind of tired of people treating Lance Stephenson like a hero when he's actually seems like a pretty bad human being. But
yeah, do we forget about this? Like the girlfriend stairwell thing, like that. I mean, that's like 2010, but like he's not a good person. He's like, I don't like this cult hero thing at all for him.
Right. Like I get the gifts or the joking tweets, but like to exalt him in any way as just, it makes me feel really uncomfortable. And I feel bad for NBA Twitter's women who have to deal with it, because I'm sure they have uncomfortable and complicated feelings about it all. And just to see him portrayed as more than just this giant, like, scumbaggy goofball, I couldn't even imagine it from their perspective. Talk about an opening digression, though. I think we should start, before we get to the sort of just looking at the futures of the teams that have been eliminated since we last recorded, a Warriors-Pelicans preview. The only update really is that Stephen Curry for this series is that Stephen Curry has been a full participant in practice the past couple days. He's questionable for game one at this recording. A lot of people have been impressed with the Pelicans, as they should be. I had Blazers in seven through the first round, and they were swept in four. Anthony Davis, spectacular. Drew Holiday has been a monster on defense all season, and his offense has really come along since DeMarcus Cousins' injury. They've been impressive. Before kind of, and you can delve into whatever specifics you want, how do you actually see this series unfolding, though? Because I have an immense respect for what the Pelicans have done. Even the coaching job Alvin Gentry has been able to do now that the Pelicans kind of resemble the team that he was brought in to coach in the first place and then never really had the opportunity to build. I really have a tough time seeing it going beyond five. Maybe if they steal game one because Curry doesn't play, or they just catch the Warriors off guard, maybe Curry plays and is rusty, perhaps it gets to six, but that feels ambitious, or at the very most like their ceiling in this series.
I mean, to me, first of all, with regard to how the Pelicans have looked, I just think it's the best recent example of sort of what happens when a real, legit, no questions asked superstar kind of hits, you know, or reaches potential or whatever, which is what Anthony Davis has done. And then it's like, it has such an organizing effect on everything around him. So Anthony Davis is like the sun that just, its gravitational field just like sucks in all the planets and puts them in the right spot, and all the orbits are perfect now, which like just couldn't have happened before. So Gentry looks like a good coach all of a sudden. Rajon Rondo is like, oh shit, this team is good, I'm gonna try now. Drew Holiday is free to be the best version of himself. And so like that's just what happens when a superstar sort of comes into his own. But with all that said, yeah, I'm not sold on the Pelicans as like this wrecking ball. But to me, I viewed this Warriors season with like a certain sense of detachment throughout the whole thing, because they clearly weren't giving full effort. They clearly were tired all year. They'd give you like 2 or 3 minutes here or there of what they could do at like max capacity. And then it's like I was just sort of waiting to see like, okay, are they gonna, you know, sort of find it? Or flip the switch gets super overused, but that's what I was waiting for. And then I was just kind of like not invested until I saw that happen, because who cares what's happening in November and December and January, February, it doesn't matter. But so now I'm still a little bit detached, because anything is on the table for them dependent entirely on Steph Curry. And so it's awesome that he's going to play in this series, I think we could say for sure. Probably will play game one. I would say if not that, definitely game two. But to me, I need to see what he looks like. If he's on the floor, I'm sort of halfway there to believing the Warriors can be the best team again and win this series in 4, 5, 6 max. But if he's out there and he looks like the guy that had the sprained MCL and came back against the Cavs a couple years ago and just wasn't himself, the Warriors can be beat. And the Pelicans aren't great, but the Pelicans could beat them. I think that is on the table. It all depends on if Steph Curry plays, and if he plays, sort of what version of him shows up. So that's not a good prediction, because I'm saying, like, I don't know, roll the dice. Like, let me know who's going to play and how they look, and then I'll tell you what I think. But I do think I really do believe anything's on the table. I don't know what I would bet on, but I think we need to not discount the fact that the Warriors are very, very gettable if Curry's not out there playing, you know, really close to his peak.
It was kind of funny how everyone seemed concerned about the Warriors' defense when you just knew that, particularly Draymond Green, that he was just going to turn it on once the playoffs started. And you go from watching what the Warriors would try and do, or general disinterest and even getting back in transition after missed shots, or even after turnovers during the regular season, and even him just doesn't seem like as crisp when he was moving around the rim, and now it just seems like he's everywhere. Like he's just disapparating in out of thin air and making stops at the rim, just basically everywhere. And that's what's, I think, big, to the point where they don't necessarily need Curry or even Curry to be close to his best to beat the Pelicans. Their offense is just so weird. And a lot of people have said this, that Kevin Durant didn't elevate the offensive ceiling. He higher its floor. Like,
yeah,
in the sense that you can survive without Curry, but you still, you watch them and the offense just doesn't run the same when he's not playing. He just has, as you alluded to, just that magnetic pull. I just don't, even if he's not, let's say he misses game one, or even if he just doesn't play well, I still find it really hard to imagine the Pelicans winning this series. And, you know, what are the defensive matchups look like? We know Anthony Davis will probably spend the most time on Draymond Green. That was how it looked during the regular season anyway. The Warriors averaged 1.1 points per possession as a team when Anthony Davis guarded Draymond Green during the regular season. Jrue Holiday actually had more success against Kevin Durant. And that's the other thing. He guarded Kevin Durant. This is the regular season matchups. He played in all three games against the, or three of the four games. Did they play each other four times this year or three? I can't remember.
It was four. I think the Warriors won three out of four.
Yeah.
I think.
Jrue Holiday defended Kevin Durant more than anyone on the Pelicans, and he defended Stephen Curry the second most of anyone on the Pelicans. You talk about a dude that has to be all over the place on defense. The thing I was surprised to find out that I looked up just before the pod was that the Warriors were averaging less than 0.95 points per possession as a team when Jrue Holiday guarded Kevin Durant. That's really interesting to me to see if maybe the Pelicans defense can do something to the Warriors offense, particularly if Stephen Curry isn't at his best. Solomon Hill, having him, maybe that helps a little bit. I don't know if you use him on Kevin Durant. Do you use him on Klay Thompson so that you don't have Etuan Moore kind of giving up size there? Klay kind of just destroyed him during those regular season matchups. I just, for me, my pick would be Warriors in five, regardless almost of what happens with Stephen Curry. And that
I
might
like
be,
it.
That might be subject to change depending on what because game one's kind of a wild card, right? The Warriors haven't played. Neither of these teams have played in a little bit. If Stephen Curry comes back, he could be rusty. You steal game one if you're the Pelicans. It opens things up, but I'm Warriors in five no matter what. I'm team Warriors in five.
Yeah, I think gun to my head, I don't see the Warriors losing the series. In terms of the number of games, I really don't know. I mean, if it goes, it sort of needs to be five or seven for that reason. Because, well, I don't know, they could win it in six on the road too. But yeah, the defensive matchups are interesting because, I mean, Holiday did have some success against Durant, but like what you saw a lot of in the Spurs series was, you know, the Warriors were really, really good about exploiting any kind of switching. And then you get Durant at the elbow with someone, you know, Patty Mills had no chance. And Holiday's bigger and a much better defender than Mills is, but he's still, he's a guard trying to handle a 7-footer that's already 15 feet away from the basket. There's definitely like high floor points to be gotten there. It's sort of like the idea of what Carmelo Anthony was in his prime is like he could get you a shot. And Durant is obviously better at that than Melo ever was, really. I think the Pelicans are sort of just a defender short because, you know, where's Rondo going to be? Is he going to guard Curry? Is he going to chase Klay Thompson around and definitely get lost and turn his head and be disengaged? I mean, is Etuan Moore going to they don't have enough. You know, they haven't really had any wing play at all. Their best units, I think, have generally been smaller with at least two guards, you know, 2-point-ish guards or three even. The Pelicans are definitely short on personnel. Literally in some senses. but they just don't have the bodies, I don't think. If they dust off Solomon Hill and think he's going to be the guy that handles Durant, I think that's going to get sorted out pretty quickly. You flip it and you're like, well, is JaVale McGee going to start on Anthony Davis? Is that really what we're going to do? Are you going to use Draymond Green on him? Is Durant going to? I mean, really, realistically, you know, when it comes down to it, the Warriors are going to have several bodies all over Davis. And I guarantee you they will force Rondo to make jump shots and they'll force, you know, whoever else is on the floor if Darius Miller gets out there or whatever. Mirotić is a problem. I guess I didn't even think about him. I think the matchups, especially with the backcourt situation in terms of, you know, the Warriors are potentially going to have three guys that you need an elite defender on. And I think at most the Pelicans have one of those guys. So that's, you know, where the series really could swing if Curry is as dangerous as he can be.
I looked this up while you were talking because we both mentioned Etuan Moore. Do you know, and I know we're probably getting too nuanced here, but when Etuan Moore defended Klay Thompson during the regular season, he played all four games, so that's not surprising, than anyone on the Pelicans. The Warriors averaged 1.31 points per possession as a team. On the
Yeah, lit them up.
That's just absolutely nuts. One of the things the Pelicans might be able to do, and I don't know if this is probably a bad thing, is that they'll force the Warriors to rely on playing small for larger portions of the game. Just we've seen what we can assume that Draymond Green's going to be all over Anthony Davis, but you don't want to have, you know, JaVale McGee into space with Mirotić, who killed the Blazers' bigs. Even Zach Collins, who's been okay in space this year during that series. And you look at that and it's like, oh, okay, but the Warriors just have the personnel. You just look at all the potential edges and the Warriors have the personnel to solve it. And I think that's why I'm just so down on this series. And the Pelicans postmortem is going to be interesting too. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves and say they're just going to get creamed, but just because of the Boogie Cousins situation, maybe this series will be fun, and I hope it is. I'm a fan of competitive series. I feel like the Warriors have a counter at pretty much every turn for the best things that the Pelicans can do. The New Orleans' best hope to me to pushing it to six would be Drew Holiday continuing to defend out of his mind, and then you need Anthony Davis to be superhuman, but then you need guys like Rondo and even Solomon Hill, if you're going to play him for his defense, they need to make these wide open threes.
Yeah, definitely. And I do think just one sort of, unimportant prediction, but I think Kevon Looney is going to play a lot in this series. I mean, he played more than I would have expected in the first round, and Kerr really trusts him. I think Jordan Bell is, you know, talk about a higher ceiling. I mean, Bell has the capacity to just really electrify the defense and be a lob threat on offense and just do all the switching that they want, but he's just not in it play to play like Looney is. Looney's a really smart player and certainly athletically limited, but Kerr really trusts him to switch everything. And so if you're going to have Mirotić spacing and you're going to have Davis at the five, I think that's probably going to take McGee off the floor a lot. And so I think Looney is someone that you're also going to see on Davis a lot as a primary defender, because I think you probably can't put him on Mirotić and expect him to cover the ground to help and recover like Green could. So oddly, I think that's, you know, this guy who the Warriors, I think, didn't pick up his option. Like, he's basically going to be gone after this year as a third year guy. He's going to be a real swing player in the series.
I can't believe that we've reached the point where you just say Kevon Looney is going to be a
swing player
in the second round playoff series.
I'm telling you. I really believe that.
I guess you're right. He did play more against the Spurs than I expected. I wasn't sure if that was just, but I don't know, Steve Kerr just like knew it was the Spurs. They don't have Kawhi. Like, he's just going to give different guys run. But that's interesting, and it would make sense to do that. I wouldn't mind. I'm more of Jordan Bell would be. I wanted them to put him in the starting lineup when they threw McGee in there instead.
Me too.
I get that he's a rookie, but so your pick would be the Warriors, and if I forced you to pick.
Can I say like 5.5? I don't want to pick 5 since you picked 5. I think
you could say Warriors in 3.
Yeah, 3. I'll just take 6. I'll say they'll win it on the road. Like, Curry will not play game 1, and let's say the Warriors lose that somehow or something. I'll just say 6, and I would comfortably take the under, but I don't want to say 5 since that's what you said.
Do you think Curry's going to play game 1?
I feel like he's angling really hard to do that.
I mean, he probably would have played game 1 of the first round series if they let him.
Well, right, yeah. he's definitely always he's come back too early from almost everything he's ever had. So thinking of it in those terms, like, yes, he will play game 1 because he probably shouldn't.
Are you a fan of the just hold him out until you lose type of scenario, or no? Do you not really?
Oh, man, that's interesting. I don't know. I think that's potentially dangerous because, like, if he's going to be back, you want to know what he's going to be able to give you.
That's true.
So, like, if you wait till you lose and then you bring him in and you expect, like, okay, fix us now, and he just can't, then I don't know what your, like, counter to that counter is. You're just out of luck at that point.
Well, we both have the Warriors. That's not a surprise. That'll be. I am interested to see the series. I'm just not. Everyone's talking about whether the Pelicans can pull off the upset. I'm not there yet with this team. And now we move on to the Cavaliers postmortem. I'm really only kidding. We might as well though, because they just look kaput. That game six was just disgusting. The Pacers played like the Cavaliers spoiled the ending to Infinity War for them. They looked pissed the entire game. Where do you want to start with? Do you have any preference where we go with the postmortems?
Let's see who got bounced first. Let's just go in order. The Spurs, or I guess the Blazers, right? They're the only team that got swept. Did you guys do them already?
Yeah, we tackled them. So that would be the Spurs.
Yeah, let's do the Spurs. Kawhi Leonard? Question mark?
Andy and I have talked about it too much because every pod, when we try and catch up on news, there's always a Kawhi Leonard update. And today there was a report from the Daily News that Kawhi Leonard wants Greg Popovich to change some things. This was a rival executive talking to Frank Cazzola of the New York Daily News. One of the things he wanted Popovich to change was the intensity of practice or something, which is just absolutely ridiculous because, one, Kawhi Leonard's the guy who didn't take the NBA Finals trophy in 2014 on like a ceremonial tour when he got it because he said his training schedule was too busy, that it just sat in his house basically. And the Spurs are one of the, this is per their beat reporters since I don't cover the Spurs, but they're one of the teams, and this doesn't surprise me, that just don't practice much throughout the regular season. There are some squads, like having been with the Nets, I know that they do practice a lot because you're dealing with a bunch of new players every year. You're also trying to install a system and a culture. So you're trying to get that hammered in, and you care more about that than wins, which is probably why you see that team monitor everyone's minutes so tightly throughout the year. But I'm at the point, I still said that Kawhi Leonard will be on the Spurs next year. I don't feel good about that, but that's just where I'm at. And I'm wondering, from someone now who's outside, because Andy and I have gone back and forth on this so much, what do you make of this, and what do you think is ultimately going to be the outcome?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, definitely something doesn't smell right. Like, something's weird with Leonard. I think we're learning that, well, first of all, his injury, from everything that I've read, is like a serious thing, and it's sort of a mercurial type of injury that, like, just takes forever to get better, and if you don't let it get better, you can rupture the tendon and all that stuff. So that, I mean, the real, like, you know, the less narrative-driven reasons for his absence, I think, are legitimate. But I think personality-wise, it's sort of just starting to feel like maybe this guy isn't just the quiet, you know, robotic dude. I think he kind of wants, I don't know, there's just more going on there that I can't presume to understand, and it makes me uncomfortable, because if you can't sort of go along to get along in San Antonio, I'm not totally sure where else you could do that. But so to me, it's kind of, the way I'm looking at it is just really like overly simplistic. If they offer him the Supermax extension, he will stay. But I don't know how comfortable I'd be doing that if I'm the Spurs because of all that's gone on this year. And if they don't, I think he probably will be gone. But everyone that's ever been offered that takes it. And it's a huge commitment. And if there's ever been a team that I think would believe in themselves and their culture and their ability to find talent that can help them win and that doesn't rock the boat like this and say, screw it, we're not going to invest $219 million in you, I could see that happening. So yeah, like, this is another cop-out answer for sure, but I really just think it's as simple as, do they offer him this extension or don't they? And then based on that, he'll be there or he won't. But this is a mess, and I just hate that it's happening to San Antonio. And I like thinking of them as this unassailable, you know, like utopia of basketball. And I think the way that this has gone with Leonard sort of cracks the facade for me.
How do you give him the DPE though? Because
can I just say that? I don't.
After appearing in, you know, you look at, you talk about Russell Westbrook getting it. You talk about the decision for the Kings to trade DeMarcus Cousins rather than give him it. Kind of the Bulls did the same thing with Jimmy Butler. You understand those decisions, but looking just at like the resume from this or the resumes, Kawhi Leonard is objectively the riskiest situation because he's appeared in 9 games this year. And to give him that money when as you alluded to with his injury, I've read things that have said it could be like this degenerative disease type of
right.
thing.
It is a disease, right? It's not like a strain. It's it is an actual condition that like just sort of is there and can just continue to get worse.
At the same time, and the other thing that makes me uneasy is just you have Popovich emphasizing his group in interviews. You have Tony Parker. I thought the thing about the injuries was ridiculous because everyone's bodies are different and you can't just say you came back from the same injury. He could have it worse. But Manu even kind of just hinting at like his shots were way more veiled than Tony Parker's. It's just also very unsettling. I ultimately don't think they're going to give him the designated player extension because they've – or maybe they will because, you know what, I didn't think they were going to sign Pau Gasol to that terrible of a deal last summer. I didn't think they were going to extend LaMarcus Aldridge and they did that. But you screw yourself for the next 6 years, really. If he comes back next year and he's just not himself, I wouldn't give it to him. And if they don't give it to him, I guess he could request out. But is he that player? And maybe he is if he's really disconnected himself from the franchise. But I think even if they don't give it to him, he'll just be back. Maybe I have too much faith in the Spurs still. But if Greg Popovich is going to lead the reconciliation charge, it's tough for me to imagine Leonard not being back, regardless of what happens with his contract.
Well, I mean, and then you mentioned Popovich, you know, like how sure are we that he's, you know, how sure are we that he's going to be back? That's a whole other thing. I just think that, I mean, I don't even know what kind of timeline I'd put on Leonard sort of not being on the Spurs. I don't know that I'd say like, oh, they're trading him the second that they put that offer on the table and he turns, you know, or the second they make clear to him that we're not going to offer this, or he says max or nothing, or it, but just like in terms of long-term future, I just don't think, I feel like something's kind of broken. And there's enough sort of in a more macro sense that is changing about the Spurs. You know, Parker, his contract's up. What's going to happen there? Ginobili, I have to assume he's going to retire. I pray he does not. I'm looking at my candlelight vigil I have set up right now in my office, trying to do like some praying to anyone I can that'll listen to have him not retire. But there's like a real shift happening for the Spurs, and it feels like Leonard could just be part of it, you know.
I'm at the point where I would, you know, 3 months ago, 4 months ago, I might have argued with you, and I can't because it just. I have no idea. And me saying that he's going to be back in San Antonio, I don't feel the least bit confident in saying that anymore. The Spurs, their overall offseason, if, you know, trading Leonard's a different story. You have to go into, are they going to try and do a rebuild if they move him? My guess would be no, just because they've seen what Lone Wolf LaMarcus Aldridge can do, and you're paying him all that money, unless you're going to try and move him too, which could be tough in this year's NBA, in today's NBA, excuse me. You also have Pau's deal. They don't really have cap space when you're looking at all their player options, guys with qualifying offers for restricted free agency, Bryn Forbes, Davis Bertans. They could get cap space if you know, Green and Gay opt out and they renounce them. You could also look at moving Patty Mills' deal, which is something I've outlined. There's a path if you really want to go for it to get cap space this summer. I don't think they explore it. I think
why do you want cap space this summer? I mean, there's a bunch of other teams, dubious restricted free agents out there. Like there's not a lot out there that I'm interested in if I'm them. I think, you know, they're going to look at it this if they were to go that way. I think you look at it like a lot of teams are, and they're going to say, screw it, I'm going to wait till 2019. Unless you think they're going to go get Chris Paul or whatever, you know?
I thought they were going to get Chris Paul last summer, to be honest with you, which is why when Pau opted out, I was like, Chris Paul going to San Antonio. But yeah, the thing with them is that they're not really well set up to get cap space now or even in 2019, because I don't think, and this is what I wanted to go through really quickly, because I don't want to spend... ultimately, they're probably not going to change much unless they trade Kawhi Leonard, but I kind of wanted to go through these players and you just give me short answers on whether you think they're going to be back in San Antonio. Tony Parker, just an unrestricted free agent. He was in the last year of his deal.
So I think I had to write a prediction on this, or like a bold prediction, and I said he was going to – this. He's done in the NBA. He's going to go play his last 2 years in that for that French team that he owns. I think he might be back, but if he is, he's not going to be making more than – I mean, he's going to make a third of what he made this year.
If that. He should be veterans minimum.
Right. He's just not – he's not like even a second stringer at this point anymore.
Danny Green is the most interesting free agent they have to me. Well, him and Kyle Anderson. I love me some slow-mo. But Danny Green, player option for $10 million. And you wrote about this too, I remember reading. And in any other year, he'd probably just decline it and then go out and get $12 or $15 million a year. It's not going to be that way this year. There are only nine teams that can have significant cap space, and a few of them aren't going to be at a point in their rebuild, their development, their whatever, where they can go out and say, hey, I'm going to pay 30-year-old Danny Green, who actually turns 30.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, I still think there's a decent chance he could just say, well, I'll just take the mid-level and, you know, 26-ish million bucks over 3 years or something. You know, that's the math is decent on that for turning down 10. But he's emblematic of how the market's going to be. Like, maybe he just takes that 10. I don't know.
That 10, DeAndre Jordan needs to opt the hell into his contract.
Oh, we could have done the Clippers postmortem a long time ago. But I think I've kind of flip-flopped on this all year, but I think Jordan's going to opt in. I think he's going to opt in, and they're going to just try to trade him. Because he's not going to – I don't know if he's going to recoup that. You know, he could get a crappy deal for like 3 or 4 years, but he's definitely not going to get average annual value of what he can get if he opts in.
It would take him at least two seasons to get that money back.
I agree.
So Danny Green, do you think he's back? Do you think you don't think he's going to opt out? That was your verdict?
Yeah, I don't think so. It's tough, though.
Rudy Gay was someone – I didn't view him in the similar light as Danny Green at the start of the season, but I thought, you know, given his age, the fact that he played pretty well after the Achilles tear, would he go out and even try and get, like, you know, 3 years at the full taxpayer mid-level, because then you double up, basically, what you were supposed to get this year? Do you think he – $8.8 million player option, do you think he picks it up, pops out?
I think he's going to – I would opt out if I were him for the reasons you said. I think you can go get – you can count on the taxpayer. And I think, you know, realistically, he could wind up with a team that has a better chance to contend than the Spurs will next year. So I think there's a really good chance that he's gone.
I agree with you there. Manu Ginobili, we already know your thoughts. You broke my heart. He has 2.5 – yeah, he's owed $2.5 million. Did you see what Steve Kerr said to him after Game 5?
No, what'd he say?
He was just talking about how he had recently met Roger Federer and how it reminded him of Ginobili. He was like, if you still love it, keep playing, what the hell? And he just literally said, what the hell? And I was just like, I love you, Steve Kerr. I'm not ready for an NBA without Manu. The dude won Game 4 for them.
I'm on my wall in my office right now, I'm looking at his Argentina jersey. So, like, I'm not ready for anything without Ginobili. I just feel like, you know, he's made some comments about how, like, this season was somehow emotionally fulfilling, and I guess, you know, you can spin it that way. But, like, I don't know, man. He's so old, and I mean, we thought he was going to retire, like, every offseason for the last three, right? And he just keeps coming back. At some point, it's going to end. I got a feeling, and I hope I'm wrong. I think he's done. If the Spurs were like going to come back next year and be just A1 title contenders again, then it's different. But I just don't see a way that that's possibly going to be the case.
Yeah, I think he's going to come back, and the fact that I'm saying that is now making me think that he won't, because I felt the same thing like for Tim Duncan after that Thunder series, and then he just retired. Just imagine Ginobili's last game was played when Popovich couldn't coach it, when Kawhi Leonard was in his New York hotel, like binge watching Liam Neeson movies, and when the Spurs got bounced in 5 games in the first round. That just feels like such a unbefitting end for him. And maybe that's why I think he's going to come back. And the other part is you watch him, and I know you said he's a million years old, but he's probably like the second fastest player on the Spurs. That's really not saying much, but he's still all over the place. And I watch him. I'm not ready for it. I'm just not ready for it. So I'm going to refuse to believe it until he says that he's not coming back.
I hope you're right. I really do.
I want to skip Anderson because I think he's the most interesting one. Laverne, he's player option for 1.7. He probably.
Oh, he's picking that up for sure.
I'm not sure he would get an NBA contract.
Agree.
Brandon Paul, non-guaranteed until August at 1.4. You keep him around, right?
Yeah, I would.
If only because you get to see someone wear the number 3 with Paul on the back in a Spurs jersey. Chris Paul. Davis Bertans, restricted free agent. They'll make both him and Forbes restricted free agents. Early Bird, restricted free agents, I believe. Do you think he's back?
Yeah, I do. I think he's one of those guys that I think gradually is going to, you know, is he could be, would it shock you if he was playing 25, 27 minutes a game next year for them?
I mean, better him than Pau Gasol at this point. I feel like that's Pau's, what I mean, just given, like, up on defensive rebounding. It's just not, he's over it.
It's the slow developmental curve of the Spurs, where I just think that he could potentially be a guy that is a real big minute rotation player. And I think the Spurs appreciate that about him. So I would, and you know, this is the other thing. We'll talk about this. I'm sure you and Andy have talked about this for every team. It's like, there just aren't a lot of teams out there with money to put forth offer sheets that are going to be, you know, like, that are going to knock these dudes over and be like, oh, yes, Chicago Bulls, I will come play. You know, it's just like,
he's also at a weird age. You know, he'll be about 26 when next year starts.
Yep. Yeah. So I think I would default to him and Forbes are going to be back, just because I think the Spurs value the investment that they've made in them, and I don't think there's going to be huge offers that dissuade them from keeping them.
I like Bertrand a lot. He's a lot quicker than people give him credit for. It'd be nice if he could rebound himself, but if he's not going, at least with, you know, he can be a high volume 3-point shooter, where Pau, he might be fine in modest volume, but I'd rather see him just a little bit more mobile defensively. He's actually an understated passer too. That was something I liked. And he gets these like random, just random help defense around the rim or random swats. I'm a big Bertans fan. Forbes is more interesting to me. I could see him being back too, but I could also see it kind of depending on, and again, it comes back, maybe they're not going to get more than close to the minimum salary in this market anyway, but maybe it's tied to Tony Parker a little bit. Like, if he doesn't come back, then you have a bigger need for Forbes. If he does come back and you're kind of interested in playing Derek White a little bit more next year, maybe you don't have as big of a need for Forbes. But Forbes was just another guy who was, I mean, they played him. He was solid. Yeah. The Spurs team was just, it was not the typical Spurs team, but they were missing a top five player, and they still flirted with that 50 win mark, and he was a guy that got actual minutes. I think he, what did he average this year? It was like almost 15 minutes a game. Or it was 19. It was almost 20. So shot 39% from three. I could definitely see him being back, but I do wonder if they have any like faith in Derek White, and then if Parker comes back, maybe that decides it a little bit.
Yeah, I think you have more thoughts on Forbes than I do. I think one thing that was really apparent is you know, I think he can be an effective regular season player. I just don't know if he's got the size to guard the types of players he's going to need to guard in the playoffs, because he's probably going to have to handle a shooting guard most nights. And I think against the Warriors, for example, he just had a really hard time with that because he's just not physically big enough to really, you know, be an impactful defender.
Yeah. The last one for the Spurs, Kyle Anderson, who's just one of my guilty pleasure watches. Do you think he's going to be back? He might be someone who could get actual money in this.
Well, that was going to be my question to you. Do you think the rest of the league values him like the Spurs would? I mean, does another team look at him and say like, oh, I see how he's going to fit in with us and how he's going to be productive? Or is it more of like, well, the Spurs squeezed like the few drops of production out of this guy. We can't do that. Because that's where I sort of lean. I think gosh, he can just look so bad sometimes, so bad, because of his physical limitations. And I just wonder if, like, if he's not on a team that is so highly functional and drilled and steeped in just perfect execution, like, is he even, can you play him? So I don't know. What do you think the league thinks of Kyle Anderson, like, in terms of as a potential guy to pursue?
I could see it tilting toward the perception that you just laid out. For me, though, I think that he would just be a little above that, at least. He can run some pick and roll, which is big. And his defense is just, like you said, he can look bad at points, but he's a lot of cross-position versatility, and there's not really a lot of that, specifically not a lot of that that's young on this market this year. That could help him drive up interest. There's something, when you watch him defensively, there's just something very Joe Ingles-ish about him. It sounds like I'm saying Joe Ingles-ish about him. He's really good at anticipating, at using space as a weapon, because he has that massive wingspan. So
he's really long.
Yeah, he can do those closeouts and make up ground, and then that allows him to guard those quicker players because he can just leave a little bit of room. And if he's going to give up the mid-range jumper, But this market just makes everything so weird. I'm like so hesitant to make any predictions. He's probably back. I think he's the one guy when you look at, maybe even more so than Danny Green, if only because Kyle Anderson is exponentially younger. He's not going to turn 25 until the end of September, whereas Danny Green's about to turn 31. He would be the biggest flight risk to me.
Yeah, well, here's the thing, because I was looking up how old he was as you were talking, and you told me before I got there. I mean, athletically, like, you know, you see conflicting reports on this, but it really seems like a player's athletic just run and jump peak is like 23, 24. And so he is now moving beyond that stage. And so what does Kyle Anderson diminishing athlete look like terms of like his ability to compete with world-class run and jump athletes? So I would have some concerns about that, because length really can only make up for so much unless you sort of move him up a position and he always is guarding bigger guys. So that would be a concern, but I'm with you. I think he's back. But my reasoning is more just like, I'm not sure other teams see a way for this really strange skill set to fit.
If he was a better three-point shooter, it would probably be an easier path towards
that. That's the difference. 100% that's the difference.
That would do it with the Spurs. Let's move on to Washington, who just lost before we recorded this. They lose game six. They were leading by as many as 12. They looked like they couldn't really do anything in the fourth quarter. The Raptors are fantastic, by the way. I love that Kyle Lowry is still... The dude's over 30, and he's diving on the ground for loose balls. I love Kyle Lowry. He's the Raptors' best player, and I also love when people get mad when someone says that.
It's ridiculous, yeah. Anyway, I agree.
So the Wizards, they're in one of the worst financial positions imaginable. Assuming Jason Smith and Jody Meeks opt into the last year of their deals, which, why wouldn't they?
Right.
They are, when you factor in their first-round pick hold, they're going to be right up against the tax. They'll be past it, the $123 million threshold. It's only by like $5 or $6 million or so when you look at just leaving the roster alone. And you can shed that. Maybe you stretch Jason Smith. Maybe you could grease the wheels of a trade or just something. But that's not including a new contract for Mike Scott, who is really good for them this year. I don't know what they do. And are they even going to be willing to use the taxpayer mid-level? That could be a valuable chip in this year's market. But are they going to be willing to spend it on a team that just really hasn't delivered? And now you have to start reconciling your future with John Wall's extension kicking in, not next year, but the year after it. Do you think it's time to break this team up in the sense, I won't even dance around it, is it time to bust up their bunny quotes big three?
Yeah, so my question to you, the first thing I was going to say was, who you trading? Because that's the only way forward, unless you want to have another season like this one, basically. I think, frankly, we are, let's see, it kicks in 2019-20, so we are a year and a half or less away from John Wall being the worst contract in the NBA, because he's going to make almost $38 million in 1920. And point guards who can't shoot, who depend on athleticism, who have had their knees operated on a billion times, do not tend to age well. So, I mean, honestly, if I could trade John Wall, I would do it, just because I don't want that contract on my books. And I think they played well enough. The debate was interesting for a while about, are they better or not without him? I think they're probably better with him, but they're not markedly better, and financially they're markedly worse. So I think Wall's the guy you try to move if you can. I don't think there's going to be any takers for him, but I would have said that about Blake Griffin too. So
yeah,
I think I think you got to bust it up. I don't know how you do it. You've got to trade one of your guys you would less like to trade. So maybe that's Beal, maybe that's Porter. But neither of their contracts are real peaches either. So I think you've got to do something. You've got to move one of those guys, free up space, so you have some kind of bench, some kind of flexibility going forward, and not a setup where you're paying, four or five guys, 13, 14 million plus or much more, and then a bunch of trash. Like, you just can't, that's not going to work.
Yeah, I'm with you on everything you said. I would trade Beal. Wall would be my pick. He might have the worst contract in the league now.
I think he does.
Yeah, so there's that. I was trying to think of teams that would go for him in a previous podcast. I came up with perhaps the Phoenix Suns would be desperate enough to do it, to get that other star blood in there, and then you know you have him under contract. It's not a Kawhi Leonard or Kyrie Irving situation where you have to worry about them leaving in free agency. He's yours all of a sudden. And if, you know, maybe you could do some things where you're willing to take back Jan Mahimi, or if you're willing to trade Josh Jackson in this year's first round pick in a deal for him. I laid out a complicated three-teamer that I'm not going to get into, but that might be a team. But he's owed so much money. No one wants to pay a 32-year-old John Wall almost $47 million.
Right, because
the final year of his deal.
Well, that's an interesting spot because, you know, normally you'd say, well, he's nowhere near their, like, their age window, you know, because the Suns are just at the very bottom, and you know, if they're ever going to be good, it's going to be on the strength of a bunch of guys who are either not on the team yet or are in their early 20s. But you're like, well, screw it. Wall's under contract for a half decade, so he'll be here. Like, he's going to be part of it. He may not be in the same age band, but the thing about moving him is that, like, I don't. So then what are you going to do? Just trying to sort of see this from the Wizards perspective of, like, what are you without John Wall? You're really like, yeah, you freed up a bunch of money, but, like, you now are depending on Beal and Porter to be your two best players, because you're not going to be able to get another big max guy in there. At least unless you clear a bunch of stuff off or you're looking towards 2020. So it's really difficult. And they've 100% done this to themselves by, you know, just throwing out these huge deals to guys, or in, I guess, Porter's case, matching the offer sheet he signed, which now I think they'd like to have that one back.
Really? See, part of the reason I would trade Beal, I recognize, one, there are, and we saw it for a tick in the Raptors series, John Wall can take over games in ways that neither Bradley Beal or Otto Porter can. And so when you're looking specifically at Beal and Wall, that's the argument for Wall there. But his contract, he's making basically twice as much as Bradley Beal starting after next year. That's just absurd. But Porter's too valuable to them. There's value to me in universal fits, and he's one of those because he's a pretty good defender. He's a pretty good defender, okay rebounder. He's just this lights-out knockdown shooter when he's healthy. He's a pretty good cutter, too. Someone else was going to give him that contract in 2016. We don't know if someone else was going to give Wall a max deal when he hit free agency.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I want all those deals back if I'm Washington, first of all. But to your point about Porter, how much better is he than Danny Green or a Danny Green type? Like, Porter's one of those guys where, like, he's very good, but there are guys out there that can do 80, 90% of what he does for a third of the cost. And so I guess if you knew that you're going to offer Wall this gargantuan contract, then and you knew it in advance, which you had to have, you've got to start thinking, like, well, we can't give an Otto Porter this much money, or we can't match that deal, because we're going to need to find, you know, the poor man's version of Otto Porter. Otherwise, if we pay Otto Porter and we pay Wall, and we know we're going to pay Beal, we're already paying Beal, like, there's just no room to move. So, I mean, Wall is a guy that you cannot replace at, like, a lower cost because of what you said. Like, he is a transcendent player when he's right. So you have to pay for that. He's not going to continue to be that. But Porter's a guy that, while really good, I think you can get a reasonable facsimile of for a lot less. So that's kind of my thinking on that.
Here would be my counterpoint to that. I agree, and that's a good way to put it, because if you're the Wizards, you could go out there, and he's not the defender that Otto Porter is, but he's done okay against some bigger guys. You could go out and get Joe Harris, who was good on pump and drives this year, who was a really good three-point shooter, and you could throw – so I get that. For me, though, with Beal, and when you look at Wall, because maybe I'm focused too much on the fact that they have this Wall contract on the books. They're probably not going to be able to move it, although, like you said, we thought the same thing about Blake Griffin. There's a Russell Westbrook element to him where if you just surround Wall with proven shooters, that the offense will hum on its own, and maybe he won't take as many mid-range jumpers that way. And Bradley Beal's a proven shooter, but he's also making $20+ million a year, and the additional benefit of him is, yes, he can create his own shot, he can kind of run the offense on his own, but you can replace his spot-up shooting, and then maybe Otto Porter's ready for a more expansive offensive role. We haven't seen it because the Wizards don't have the leeway to experiment in that regard. And when you look at what Porter does on defense compared to Beal, it's not a hard decision for me.
Yeah, well, you know what's interesting about the Wizards is that, like, Their half court offense, I think particularly in the playoffs, I won't get the stat right, but it's been pretty shitty. And like, they are always a team that if they're not getting buckets in transition, they struggle to score. So I don't know how much. I mean, you flash in your head the John Wall just hitting weak side corner 3-point shooters 8-10 times a game, and you're like, why isn't that offense just perfect every time? I think that one thing that they really do need, and maybe this is something they can more realistically address, is a role guy that you can just throw a lob up to. Gortat is not that guy. There's no vertical spacing there. There have been seasons where he's been an awesome pick and roll scorer. It's really efficient. But I think what would help them a lot is someone that you really have to sink to when you're playing pick and roll defense against John Wall and a big guy, because Mahinmi's not that. Gortat's not that. It's kind of interesting when they played Morris at center sparingly, because he can do a little more of that, but he's not the answer there. So maybe center is where they need to really look for something.
That Mike Scott could end up being a killer loss for them, because I'm assuming he'll get more than the minimum this year, even in the way the market's shaping out. He was big for them. I did not like watching Markieff Morris and Mike Scott play together. They were a disaster, but he, to me, was very clearly a better fit for the most part than Markieff Morris is.
Yeah, well, I mean, Scott is a guy, if you told me Mike Scott was going to Miami and he was going to down to like 4% body fat and just do a James Johnson, except be like a more of a scoring mentality guy, like I would buy all the Mike Scott stock. But I feel like he's just so hit or miss. I mean, he's basically out of the league for a decent amount of time. So I don't know. I definitely, if you told me that he was going to give the Wizards what he gave them in the playoffs, that would hurt them. But I'm not totally sold he's going to be like, this is who he would be if he were back for, you know, on a new deal with them.
Give him to Boston at part of the taxpayers' mid-level. That would be an interesting fit for him. Yep. So for the Wizards, to wrap them up, do you find it more likely that they'll try and make smaller moves on the margins and just run it back with this same core? Do you think that maybe instead they'll try and use Marcin Gortat, Markieff Morris, their other expiring deals with Smith and Meeks to possibly take back, I don't want to say necessarily bad salary, but someone who just might be able to help them and then really double down on this core? Or do you think they'll ultimately trade a member of their, again, bunny quotes, big three?
I think it's unlikely that that breaking it up, even though we spent all this time talking about that being what they should do, I don't think that's going to happen, just because it's so hard to do that just mechanically. And I think too, you've sort of got some built-in excuses. Wall missed some time. The Raptors are really good, so there's really no shame in losing in six or whatever. I think they can talk themselves into this core, you know, that, like you say, the bunny quotes big three being like viable. And certainly it's a bad look to invest all this money and then just be like, nope, this isn't going to work, you know, within a short amount of time. So I think it is more realistic and more likely that they'll kind of mess around on the margins and see what they can do.
I'm inclined to agree with you there. And they run into the interesting problem like the Blazers did, or will, with you're not going to move Damian Lillard because he is your franchise. John Wall, it's different because his contract isn't that great. But if you're not going to move him, Bradley Beal's not. It's like that CJ McCollum factor. What is he actually going to get you if you try and change him out for spare parts? It's not going to be that much.
Yeah, that's a good point. Just out of curiosity, did you guys think that the Blazers would try to move McCollum?
No, I mean, they have to kick around the tires on that. I was reading something, though, a few weeks ago that basically said that McCollum is Olshi's guy because he wasn't really responsible for Lillard. He kind of came in late during that, I believe. And I would need to double check that. This is now the second time I'm mentioning it, so maybe I haven't checked it already.
I think that's actually right.
So he has some sort of loyalty to McCollum. And yeah. I, thinking about it more, I just, what do you get for CJ McCollum? He's not, because there's no team that's going to be able to afford to take on Evan Turner's contract in addition to CJ McCollum. And he's not an all-star. His defense is still not good. He's not this exceptional playmaker. He's super smooth on the offensive end, don't get me wrong. But what are you actually getting for him? This isn't a Kyrie Irving situation. Maybe if you were trading Damian Lillard, that's the type of return you could get, but you don't have the Cavaliers. It's not working out for them, obviously, but they had LeBron James. So you talk yourself into getting those ancillary devices like Jay Crowder and Isaiah Thomas and those guys. You can't do that if CJ McCollum is going to be your best player after a trade.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know if Olshay should have much job security, honestly. I mean, the Turner contract was just crippling, and the whole Allen Crabbe situation, anytime you have to just give a guy away after matching an offer sheet on him like a year ago, like, what are you doing? Do you not have any forecasters that are telling you that you're just hamstringing your entire organization? Like, the Turner contract is unforgivable. If they max out, if they give Nurkic anything, you know, close to the max, or I don't know, if they match a big offer for Nurkic, I think like Olshay is just, I don't know what he's thinking.
Yeah, luckily, I don't think they'll have to worry about a max, like a big offer for Nurkic. The other thing is don't, the way, if you're going to keep Stotts, which I think they should.
Agree.
Olshay's the one that should be on the hook. I think they recently extended him, so maybe that's the politics there, and it's easier to get rid of Stotts and blah, 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 blah. But
yeah. Well, and if you get rid of Olshay, you're going to get rid of the coach too, because the new guy's going to want to hire his own coach. So, like, you can't really, it'd be shocking if that's the way it went.
That's true. But if Stotts is going to be there, you don't need to pay a big man a lot of money. It's statistically proven. Ben Falk at Cleaning the Glass wrote about it, and Nurkic was exposed in the series against the Pelicans. I get not every team has Anthony Davis, but there are a bunch of teams now that have more mobile centers, and he's not the guy that's going to help you against them.
Agree.
That was interesting. I wanted to go to the Minnesota Timberwolves, and we ended up with the Portland Trailblazers for a minute. So you're welcome, Portland fans, or we're sorry, Portland fans. Minnesota, I'm not sure I could be lower on the future of a team that has arguably two top 20 guys and at least one top 10 guy in Jimmy Butler. I don't know there's no path to cap space for them. There's none. They have the non-guaranteed deal on Cole Aldrich. If they're lucky, I shouldn't say lucky, they should be able to access the full MLE, $8.6 million about this year, without having to worry about hitting the tax. And there will be value in that this summer. But you look at this, Russell. That Andrew Wiggins contract looked terrible now. I don't know. That Jeff Teague deal doesn't look too shiny. He's fine. That's like our motto for Jeff Teague on the podcast is he's fine.
That's the perfect motto for Jeff Teague.
Gorgie Jang is – why did you – and because this is Tibbs. He's president. Why did you sign him to that extension? Why? Because you don't really play him or rely on him in any way. And then you went and that very next summer you gave Taj Gibson $14 million a year. Yes, just over 2 years, but I cannot be – again, I don't think I could be lower on their future. I'm stuttering. What do you make of the Timberwolves?
Oh, I feel like every one of these – well, certainly the last couple we've talked about – feel stuck. They feel really stuck. And the problem is twofold to me. One is just like you've mentioned, there's just no wiggle room here financially because you signed all these guys to dubious contracts. But then the other problem is, you know, and this was true for most of this year, I really think that, you know, Tom Thibodeau, in addition to being a bad executive, he's not someone that I think his, and this is going to really blow your doors off. No one else has ever said this. He's not someone that I think like trusts his bench guys enough to excel. Like, I think Tyus Jones should have been playing a lot. And the on off stuff for him is insane. I think Nemanja Bjelica, if you had developed him all year, and maybe Timberwolves fans will come back at me and say he's just not this type of guy. But Bjelica was someone that like really should have mattered against the Rockets. He really should have mattered because he can space the floor and he can like he can dribble the ball and make a decision. But he just couldn't get on the court. And Jamal Crawford, I think, shouldn't play over either of those guys. But he's going to pick up that player option, I have to assume, and continue to play a bunch. And God knows what's going to happen with Derrick Rose, because if there's a team that's willing to get stupid about him and give him whatever exception,
he's getting that MLE.
He's getting that MLE. it's going to be the Timberwolves. So yeah, I think that they are mismanaged, and I think mismanaged in two senses, one financially and two in terms of how the personnel is deployed. So it's really shitty that a player as talented as Karl Anthony Towns and now and in the future, and a player as talented as Jimmy Butler sort of have to try to operate in the middle of this.
Yeah, and it's funny how now people are getting cute, I want to say, by saying Karl Anthony Towns isn't special because the Timberwolves don't know how to use him. They're talking about how he isn't in the post enough and doesn't have that go-get-it attitude. Perhaps that's accurate to some extent, but when you look at the amount of time he diverts to the corner or just the amount of time he spends outside of the paint beyond the arc, it seems like coaching, does it not?
I agree.
He's their best shooter at this point too, so that would make sense.
This is the thing. So I agree, because at first I was like, why? I was doing the old man thing of like, demand the ball, like, go get it, you know, exert your will. Like, the, you know, I was like on Inside the NBA, just like spouting platitude type stuff. But I agree. I think that was a schematic decision to put him in the corner. But here's the effing problem with what the whole thing with the Timberwolves. You've got a center that can shoot 40% on high volume from three, and you took fewer threes than anyone in the league. This is inexcusable. I don't understand how you can have a player as talented as Towns who can stretch a center out to the three-point line, and if they run at him, he will drive around them and dunk, or you can have him shoot 8, 9, 10 threes a game, whatever you want. He can do Brooklyn Nets, Brooke Lopez impressions, and you just aren't taking threes as a team. So I have zero confidence that even if they miraculously, like, change their financial future, that Thibodeau is going to deploy these guys in a way that maximizes their talent. I'm so down on almost everything about how this team is run.
Well, that's what, and it's, so my, I would say they need shooting. And I mentioned Joe Harris before. That might be, that's a guy that they can afford. There will be other potentially cheap shooters on the market. They're not going to be able to poach someone like Trevor Ariza. Maybe Danny Green, if he leaves San Antonio at the MLE, he'd be good for them. But can you trust Thibodeau to play them? Because it's obvious to us, and you look at, you talk about the regular season stats, it's why I was almost surprised that they won a game against the Rockets. The Rockets had the highest three-point attempt rate in the league. The Timberwolves had the lowest. And then you just, if you look at the five-game series specifically, the Timberwolves made more three-pointers per 100 possessions than I thought they would, 9.3. The Rockets still made 15.4 per 100. So you're essentially just, you're starting the game off in that, or that's an 18-point deficit just there per 100 possessions. That's not going to work in today's NBA. And so you say, if they go out and get shooters, maybe there is something. And there is truth to that. But will Thibodeau use them? Because you look at the most used lineup in the league this year, in terms of possessions, according to Cleaning the Glass, was Charlotte. Kemba Walker, Batum, Kid Gilchrist, Marvin Williams, Dwight Howard. The second most used, most played lineup in the league was Minnesota's starting lineup of Teague, Wiggins, Butler, Gibson, Towns. They played 2,260 total possessions, which is only 13 fewer than that starting lineup in Charlotte did. And to be able to say that when Jimmy Butler missed 23 games, and you
right.
also had Teague miss 12, and I don't think there was overlap there at all in their injuries, that's pathetic. He's yeah. not a guy that's going to go to his bench. So you say this, go out and get shooters. Will he even use them? Does it
that's
matter?
That's the thing. That's the thing. Go out, yeah. So you say, well, they need depth. Okay, go out and get depth. Well, he's just not going to play him. They need shooters. Okay, go out and get. So say they get three awesome 3-point shooters. The team doesn't fucking shoot threes. Like, that's the problem. There are decent shooters on this team, but like, they just don't shoot it. I mean, you could construct really good spacing, I think, if you've got Teague, Butler, Wiggins, Towns. That's four guys that, I mean, Butler's probably the least of them, that you've got to at least account for. Like, you've got to space them. And you could throw a fifth guy out there. Bielitsa is a floor spacer. Like, that's his offensive role, really, or that's what it ought to be. Even if it's like as an up fake and drive guy. Like, they've had the personnel to put good shooting lineups on the floor. And it's just they just don't operate that way.
They need Andrew Wiggins. They need him to be more efficient, too, if he's going to have a – it should be an easier role, but when you're used to having the ball in your hands, that simplicity is almost counterproductive or disingenuous. He just looks so uncomfortable, especially if you're not going to run him off a ton of screens and have him make more beelines towards the basket. And the last question with this team then would be one of their better shooters, Bielitsa, is a restricted free agent. Do you think he's back?
I don't know. Maybe they've depressed his value enough that nobody's going to go like, here's the mid-level or, you know, something like that. If I'm him, I don't think I want to be back, first of all. I'm going to guess he's gone. It just feels like Minnesota's going to look at him and be like, well, he didn't help us and he's not that young. And so why do we want him back?
And when you're already paying Jang and you're paying Gibson. And maybe they could get weird and play Wiggins at the four, maybe like Towns and Wiggins as your just to try it. I don't that might be something that's interesting. Do you think they're going to give Towns an extension? It's not. Do I think he's going to leave? But their cap situation is such that you look at 2019. If Jimmy Butler leaves, which I don't know why he'd stay if this is the Timberwolves team that he's still on. I guess maybe if I'm the next team after Jimmy Butler spent another two additional years under Tibbs, I don't know if I want a part of his next contract.
So oh, no way. No way. He's going to be, yeah, he's going to be washed after this. I mean, like, he's, yeah, there's no way I want any of that. I think so Wiggins' deal was 4 years, right? They didn't DPE him.
No, he got five and 154.
He did? About, yeah. Oh, that's right. Cause the Basketball Insider's, chart only goes to 21-22 right now. So I can't see that fifth year.
Yeah. It was, the value has always been weird. I think it's like 5 and 154 basically.
What a dumb contract.
Glenn Taylor made him promise that he would get better at basketball.
Yeah. Right. It's making me think of when I have my 4 year old promise me things. It's like, yeah, sure. And he doesn't remember 5 minutes later. I don't know. I mean, I would do whatever I could to lock down Towns. I'm not persuaded, based on this postseason, that like he's going to be anything less than like a franchise cornerstone. So I'm locking him up as soon as I can for whatever it takes, honestly. Like, I just think you can't let a talent like that have any second thoughts about like what his position in the franchise is.
And it's not a Porzingis situation where he's been injured, or in the Knicks' case, they have that clear path to flexibility in 2019. So you might as well delay the huge cap hold. They're better off. You don't want him to get frustrated and be tempted to, no one ever does this really, unless you're Greg Monroe. You don't want to tempt him to accept a qualifying offer. It's just, I don't know that you have the goodwill right now. Maybe you do in that confidence, but it's Tibbs. So I don't know what he's,
Yeah, that throws a real wrench in the works. Can we? I mean, Stan Van Gundy. I think it's Stan Van and Tibbs are the only coach head personnel guys left, right? And Van Gundy kind of got demoted this past season. I think that's right, right?
Yeah.
So Tibbs has to be the last.
Wait, Van Gundy hasn't been demoted just yet. We're like kind of waiting on it.
Well, but they've got, who's the agent they've got that were, is,
yeah, it was, he was unofficially demoted, maybe, but. At the same time, that Blake Griffin deal,
yeah, had like that reeked of Stan Van. So, but I just want to say that Tibbs needs to be the last guy ever, right? That gets this kind of power. This, I mean, we've seen it. We've seen enough. Like, there is no scenario in the future. There's no guy out there. Like, if the Celtics offered this to Brad Stevens, I would be like, nope, Brad Stevens cannot handle this. Steve Kerr, nope. Like, there's no one out there that should ever have this dual position ever again. I think the verdict is in on this now.
You know what we really need in the NBA? You need more clarification on what the roles are, because Greg Popovich is the team president of the Spurs, but know that RC Buford's primarily responsible for what happens, and that's fine. If president's just going to be, it's like that producer credit that actors get when a show gets syndicated, basically, that they're on, so they get more money. Fine, like fine. If the coaches, good for them. Give all the money you want to coaches. They work their asses off, most of them. Give them money. It should not actually amount to anything. I'm with you there. And there just needs to be more of a clear cut thing, because Greg Popovich is the president of the Spurs, but I don't think that, I mean, maybe I'm sure he has a huge say, which is maybe someone like that, it's okay to get their input, but I would think that Buford's making the final calls. And yet then you go to Toronto, where Ujiri was just promoted to president recently. It's just like, what the hell do these titles mean? Like, let's have some type of clear hierarchy that might allow for you to give these guys kind of those do nothing, or these, they call them no show roles in Hollywood. I think that's like fine. That's fine. But you're right. There should be no substance to it.
No. And this is the problem, is Tibbs has all that power. And so when you talk about like, well, how do you fix the Timberwolves? You'd say like, well, I think I probably want someone else making decisions. It's like, well, that's the one thing you're not going to get for quite a while.
It's interesting, because everyone was, I can't remember if I actually criticized or liked the Tibbs hire in Minnesota. I probably
said, I'm pretty sure I liked it. I assume I liked it.
What I've seen happen to him in Minnesota has made me appreciate a guy like Steve Clifford a lot more, who is no longer employed, just because he adapted in Charlotte a lot better than Tibbs ever had. When you look at how his offense changed during his half decade there, that would be a coach that I think might actually be good for a Timberwolves team. Or let's move over. Like, you talk about the Suns, they're going to interview Tibbs. They interviewed Clifford. You can see him taking over a young team and it being okay. Whereas Tibbs, it's clearly, I don't think it's going to work.
Yeah, Tibbs is, I mean, it's not uncommon, you know, in just life in general. Like, he's kind of a victim of his own success. Like, he did a thing that worked. The circumstances that led to it working changed, and he continued to do it. Like, the rules changed, defenses changed, the offensive schemes got smarter, the league you know, kind of mathed up and changed how it played on offense, and he just didn't. And so it's got to be hard just from like a psychological perspective to be like, well, I know this thing worked, but I'm going to scrap it. Like, I sort of sympathize with him in that sense, because sort of your world would turn upside down if you, and he's a rigid guy anyway. But like, yeah, it's just, it's not going to work unless he changes. And I don't think he's going to change. So, you know, sorry, Timberwolves.
Now, I know you said we're at the time where you said you had to get out of here. Do you have time to do the Miami Heat, our last team, really quick?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, Miami Heat. What are you? I'm just, my one line take would be they're pretty much going to look basically the same next year.
Yeah, unless they can move Whiteside, which there are rumblings. But who on earth wants, you know, a center that is way older than you think, that doesn't try hard all the time, that is just a, there's a giant target on him for every opponent's pick and roll. But yeah, they have like a lot of good players, and I think there's a great chance they'll be in the playoffs again next year and could win 45 games with roughly the same roster. But yeah, like, you know, I think they'll probably lose Wayne Ellington, because I think he's someone that, as an unrestricted free agent, should get paid. Don't you? I mean, like, I think he's a legit floor spacer that can make and take a bunch of really difficult threes. Like, I don't know who shot more threes on the move, like leaning 45 degrees to the side, than he did
in NBA history. Probably no one.
Like, I mean, his threes were, degree of difficulty was just off the charts, but like, you know, it's tough. Tyler Johnson's going to make $19 million next year. You've got
shout
all these guys.
Shout out to the Brooklyn Nets for that contract.
Dude, the Brooklyn Nets, I like almost everything Brooklyn does, including just like, all right, we're going to screw you. We kind of want Tyler Johnson, but sort of don't really care. But you're going to pay him this stupid contract. Like, I like how they operate. I like everything about what Brooklyn does.
They need to do that to Zach LaVine this summer. The Nets aren't
yes
they can't first of all be stupid to give him max. I don't think Chicago's dumb enough to maybe they are, maybe they're bullish.
I don't know.
He was the centerpiece of the Butler trade at the time.
Yep.
But they can they're gonna basically sleepwalk their way to more than 15.3. I have them at, when accounting for holds and everything, and they could easily get a little bit more. If you throw Zach LaVine $18 million a year, that's just enough money where it screws the Bulls, but it's not too much where you would think that the Bulls would just walk away. That would be hysterical to me. Maybe even do that to Jabari, although the Bucks are probably more confident in giving him 15 or 18 than anyone should be giving Zach LaVine 15 or 18.
That Bucks postmortem is going to be interesting, by the way.
Yeah, Thon Maker's making it more difficult too by the game.
That's true.
The random Thon Maker quote: of all the players who've contested at least 50 shots at the rim during the playoffs, he leads the league in defensive field goal percentage right now for the playoffs. It's just like, I saw that before, and it's ingrained in my head. I'm not even looking at it right now. The Bucks are going to be looking at Parker's uneven performances, but they're not really the Heat. Although they are a team that some people think might be the one to make a play for Whiteside, unless Miami's going to eat Dellavedova and Henson, I don't see it.
Yeah, I don't see it either. And I don't think you want to introduce, well, it'll depend on who the coach is, because it's not going to be Joe Prunty.
What happens, though, if the Bucks just, what if they win Game 7, and then you go into the next round, you beat the Sixers? What happens if you make the Eastern Conference Finals?
I still think you go try to hire Mike Budenholzer or somebody. Like, I don't.
The more you win, the less likely it is that Mike Budenholzer or David Fizdale is available.
That's true.
Maybe they wait to get the interview with them.
Well, I think every coach is waiting until they see what the Bucks, because the Bucks situation is obviously the best. I think every coach is going to wait to see who can where the dominoes fall after that. But back to the Heat. I don't know. Like, I think we kind of knew this was coming, right? This situation, because when they signed Johnson and Waiters and Olynyk and to these, like, oh, okay, that's, you know, reasonable deals, reasonable 4-year deals for between, you know, 10 and like 14 million for, you know, whatever. And they all escalate a little bit, but it's like, yeah, you're kind of locking into this. These guys are tradable theoretically. But you know, you're putting a cap on like how good you can be. So I don't really know what Miami can do. If Wade comes back, I don't know what they would give him. Is he going to be a minimum guy, or are they going
to
give him like a nice?
It has to be, right?
Well, and then, you know, he'll sort of magically become like the manager of like a Carnival cruise ship or something. It's like, hey, you get to keep this after you retire. They'll do something on the side. But yeah, I don't know how they get better, especially if they're going to have to contend with losing Ellington potentially.
And maybe they were gearing up for life without him, just because it seemed like Spo was trying way too hard to make those three non-shooter lineups work. Where you had, what was it, Wade, and I know Winslow hit his threes over the second half of the year or for most of the year, but he's not a high-volume guy, and you had Whiteside on the floor at the same time, or it was Adebayo. You have those three guys, and it's essentially, at the most I could say about them in a good light would be three unproven shooters, but it's three non-shooters. And yeah, maybe they're trying to get, I don't know how you, to me, I think he's back. You have his early bird. I think you have his early bird rights, or he's not full bird, is he? I think he's early bird. It's, how do you get rid of him when you don't really have that other proven floor spacer?
What do you pay him? What do you think like his market, what is the Wayne Ellington market rate right now?
Do you think, am I selling him short by saying taxpayer mid-level at 5.5 about?
I mean, that's less than he made last year. But
he's,
I guess
he's also 30, isn't he? He's like pretty old too. He's just,
yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I feel like the market being so weird this year is just makes everything strange. But like, I mean, if this was like, what was the ridiculous summer, 2015, when Batum and everybody got $100 million contract?
2016. Feel like forever ago though?
It really does. It all runs together. Like Ellington would have got, I mean, like 4 for 52 or something that summer if he was coming off this year. I don't know. So let's say he's back. I mean, one thing you made me think of, I was down on these guys saying like, I don't see how they get better. If Winslow adds volume, I think suddenly he is like, you know, there's borderline star potential, I think, in Winslow still, if he takes that leap as just a 3-point shooter. Like if he could shoot 6-7 a game, and make like 36%, 37%. I'm kind of in on him as someone who should definitely start and is a huge piece. And then I like Adebayo a lot. So maybe you just sort of price in some organic growth, and that prevents you from overspending on Ellington. But if you're telling me I can get him at 5.6, well, then that's different. But I would like to think that there will be a decent market for him, and or, you know, he'll do something like I think might happen with a lot of veterans this summer, is they'll realize the money's not out there. They're going to take a below market deal and play for a contender and then up their value in like big stage minutes and then get back onto the market in 19. So I think that is something you could potentially see from Ellington or other guys like Danny Green or whatever.
Do you know where I would, well, I guess the question, is there a little bit of the Spurs with Kyle Anderson element to Ellington? Where, yes, he's hitting these ridiculously difficult threes, but can you replicate that model on another team, or can you at least instill that same trigger-happy mindset in him? I don't know if you listened to Rob Mahoney's breakaway pod for SI.com. Did this whole thing on Wade Ellington on how the Heat had to drill into him. No hesitation. You need to shoot. And he was literally benched if he took a dribble or tried to pass.
He's kind of like CJ Miles. CJ Miles doesn't, I mean, every time he touches it for the Raptors, it's out of his hands. I mean, you could put him on the Sixers, because all those guys do is run off ridiculous pin downs and shoot like leaning, fading threes. Like that suddenly that was their whole offense in the first round. I don't know. I think increasingly you're going to see offenses not necessarily built around, but that heavily feature guys like Ellington that just catch the ball at these crazy angles on dead sprints and fire threes. Cause like if you make 33% of those, that's a good shot. You know? I think as the league continues to change offensively, I think you could replicate what Miami did with him. And I think you'll see a lot of other teams try this with like Ellington types to the extent that exists. I think it's only going to get more common.
Him in New Orleans would be interesting, particularly if they let Boogie go too.
Yeah, I would like it there. I'd like any kind of shooting there, or any kind of guards with decent size that can shoot it. I'm all in on that for the Pels.
Imagine if he went to Minnesota and you just saw his value crater because Tibbs wouldn't have him move at all. They'd have him stand in the corner and never be open.
Yeah, he would bench him for failing to ice a pick and roll, and then he would average 2 3-point attempts per game, and he would just be useless. That's what happened. That shooters go to Minnesota to die, I think, needs to be like their next tagline.
Who is the most, and this will be the last question on the Heat, who is the, they're going to make a trade, I think it's safe to say. Who's the most likely player to be traded?
Oh, man.
They would like it to be Dion Waiters.
They would love it to be Dion Waiters. I mean, like, the easiest guy to trade is the guy you should least want to trade, right? So, I mean, like Olynyk is very – Olynyk's contract's really palatable. I mean, he could play starting center for a lot of teams. And so he would be the easiest – probably the easiest to trade of those guys. I don't know. That's really tough because if you trade Waiters, you're going to have to sweeten it, even though he's not making a ton. Gosh, what are my choices? Can't trade Whiteside. Yeah, you know what? I think Whiteside is the most likely to be traded.
Because they just moved.
I think they just have to. And I think Riley is the Heat do things that seem impossible all the time. In terms of like who they've been able to get and move and things like that. I mean, they traded a zillion firsts for Goran Dragic. Like they made it happen. So where there's a will, there's a way. I don't think it makes sense to trade any of those. I mean, Waiters, sure, but I don't know. I don't know how you do it. And there's just so much. The Whiteside relationship just seems over, don't you think? I mean, he's every other game he's mouthing off about his coach in the media. He's disgruntled.
Spo handled that very well during his exit interview, by the way.
Spo always handles it well. I think a lot of other coaches, I mean, maybe behind the scenes, I'm sure he's just ripping into him, you know, to his assistants. But, like, I don't know. Maybe that's a bold prediction, but I think it seems almost impossible to trade him. But it seems also really clear that like they have to do it. They just have to because it's getting to like kind of a toxic level right now.
I almost feel like it's going to be Justice Winslow, although I'm not sure how much value he has.
Why would you trade him?
Yeah.
How much
is he going to cost you in 2019? I'm going to assume they're not going to extend him unless he's willing to take far less than his cap hold would be. In 2019, it's like the Kristaps Porzingis situation with the Knicks. It's just that he's injured, but if he's going to say, hey, I'll take $50 million a year, yeah, then you extend him. But unless Winslow is going to take like 12, like 4-48 or something, I don't.
Yeah, well, maybe that's the type of thing where to get off Whiteside, you got to throw Winslow in there or something like that. I don't know. Maybe the Heat don't value cap flexibility enough to do something that crazy.
That's the other part of it. You're not slated to have flexibility until 2020 at the earliest. There's so much there. I kind of feel like Winslow just he might be the means for them to improve. Maybe partner him with James Johnson, or maybe does he get you off Dion Waiters' contract? Probably not. Do you even view him in that light where he can just be that sweetener because he has value to them, especially if he's gonna hit his threes.
Yeah, I'm just looking at their cap sheet. Like, what is with the Heat and player options? I mean, like, does any other team have? I mean, Johnson's got one in 1920. So does Dragic. So does Whiteside. Yeah, and in 2021, James Johnson's got one, and so does Olynyk. I hate player options. I don't know why they do that. It's just you're betting on like getting it wrong almost.
Yeah, the Olynyk contract is fine to me. The Johnson contract I said was an overpay at the time. It might never look bad, but he's gonna be 34 at the end of
that. Yeah, the age thing is a problem on that.
The Waiters one is just, good for him for getting paid. I'm all for players, but I just woof. The last question on them, because we did this with Ginobili. Dwayne Wade, is he retiring or no?
I think he will. I'm going to say yes. Just because it feels to me like he's maybe got, like, his life seems pretty awesome, right? Like, it seems like he's got a good life and he seems like pretty intelligent and seems like he has a lot of perspective. And I could see him just being like, well, I don't want to play anywhere else. I could play for the Heat again. We're not going to be that good. Or I could just like hang out with my wife in Miami and just have a great life and live on the yacht that Mickey Arison's going to give me. So I think, I don't know. It's almost a coin flip, but I just kind of feel like maybe he's done. What do you think?
I honestly, I don't have a pulse on him because I agree with everything you just said. At the same time, it didn't feel like this was supposed to be his last season. It almost felt like we were waiting. He was in Cleveland and then he would just do whatever LeBron James did this summer. And then he's made it clear that he wouldn't leave Miami in free agency. And why do you want to play out what's left of your career? You're 36 on a team that second round ceiling, maybe because nothing, they don't have a ton of upside on this roster. There's Josh Richardson. what is Justice Winslow going to be, the best version of himself? You're paying Whiteside when your best lineups probably need to have Olynyk or Adebayo at the five, who Adebayo, by the way, this year had more assists as a rookie than Whiteside did through his first five seasons.
Adebayo, like, there is a future scenario where Adebayo is really, really, really good. Especially if, and you saw flashes, like you said, of if he can be like an elbow offensive hub, which I think is realistic, and then just be a monster, like, athletically on defense. But yeah, the Wade thing, he definitely did not look washed in this series. Like, there were definite moments where he was really productive and dangerous, but I don't know how interested he's going to be in, you know, coming off the bench and going through the grind of a regular season, just for one more crack at, you know, 25 minutes a game off the bench in a first round series that they're going to lose again. I don't know how that's got a lot of appeal.
More likely to retire though, Ginobili or Wade?
Ooh.
I would pick Wade, and that's as definitive as I can get on the Wade front.
More likely to retire. I think Ginobili is more likely to retire because I'm reverse jinxing the situation. I'm going to continue to tell everyone I talk to that he's done, and then that way he'll come back.
This podcast has been thoroughly depressing because of that. I want Ginobili back more than I don't remember that I've wanted. It wasn't even like this with Duncan for me. I don't remember wanting a player to retire less than Manu Ginobili.
I know. It's he's my favorite player in the league. And he's been forever. I just feel like it's over. I hate it. I hate that I feel that way. I'm setting myself up to be emotionally uplifted when he sends the tweet that says like one more year or something.
Yeah, you know what? I'm going with you. Manu Ginobili is 100% going to retire.
Yep.
That seems like a good place to stop. We did almost 90 minutes on these future breakdowns for teams that have been eliminated. We even delved into the Blazers a second time. Grant, thank you so much for being generous, not only with your time now, but for hopping on tonight. Big ups for that. And you had to tackle a couple extra things because the Wizards decided to no-show in the fourth quarter against the Raptors. You need to follow Grant on Twitter. You will not regret it. @GT_Hughes. Definitely read his stuff on Bleacher Report, one of my favorite writers to read. He will be back on the pod soon, I'm sure. He is officially now titled Friend of the Pod, Grant Hughes. We also talk outside of the pod too, though, so it's not all just that illusion where your favorite band really doesn't talk outside of work. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm @DanFavale, Favale. If you want to follow NBA Math, our host, @NBA_math. Definitely follow Andy on Twitter and tell him to feel better, because not only is he sick, but as we talk about this, the Jazz are surprisingly tied with the Thunder somehow, even though I feel like Utah's played like absolute piss through the game from what I've seen while we've been doing this. You can also follow Hardwood Knox @HardwoodKnox. We will actually be coming to you on a bunch of different mediums starting sometime soon, hopefully. We've heard your feedback and know you want us on Google Play and Spotify. We should also be up and running on TuneIn soon. We'll be all over the place. Get excited about that. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes, though. That's the best way to help the pod at this point. I do not have to give a shout-out to you-know-who because Andy's not here, but I am going to give a big-time, massive shout-out to who we both believe will still be a Spur next season, Kyle Anderson. Until next time.